May it please the court, Tom Leatherberry here on behalf of Appellant Arch Reinsurance Company. My colleague Ann Weber is here with me at council table. After spending just a moment outlining State National's somewhat unique three-party business model, I'll turn to the contract formation issues that demonstrate that the jury's answers to questions 1A and 1B are immaterial. Then I'll turn to the equitable estoppel issues, which we contend show that the jury's finding to question 2A is also immaterial, and why the judgment should be reversed and rendered for my client Arch Reinsurance in the stipulated amount of more than $2 million. State National had a specific and somewhat unique three-party business model, and that's established in Joint Exhibit 1, which is the reinsurance agreement. First, State National issued homeowners insurance policies, but State National had no liability for any of the claims. They received a portion of the premiums for issuing the policies. My client, second, Arch Re, was the reinsurer of 100% of liability on all of these homeowners insurance policies. They're 100% liable for all claims. Premiums were ceded to Arch Re since it bore 100% of the risk, and State National very carefully vetted Arch Re's financial condition, because Arch Re did bear 100% of the risk and State National bore 0% of the risk on the homeowners insurance policies. The third leg of the triangle was Underwriter Service, Mr. Herman's client. Underwriter Service was an Oklahoma general agent who sold and serviced the policies. They received a specified commission for their efforts. It was 30% under the reinsurance agreement, but it was subject to a true-up. It could go up to 33.5% or down to 27% based on the loss ratios, based on the simple calculation of how much or how many claims had been paid, how much had been paid in claims, and how much had been collected in premiums. In 2002, underwriters got additional commissions because the loss ratios were good. They were low. But then Oklahoma had some catastrophic weather years, one right after another. So in 2003, Underwriter Service stopped sending the annual reports to Arch Re that they owed them, showing that, in fact, for those years, 2003 through 2006, underwriters owed Arch Re some return commissions. By 2007, Underwriter Service owed Arch Re over $1 million in return commissions, and because of the loss carry-forward provisions in the reinsurance agreement, it was unlikely that Underwriter Service would make more than the absolute minimum commission under the reinsurance agreement, which was 27%.
Can I clarify something? So in years 2003 to 2007, at the time renewals came up, I guess, or the contract renewed almost annually unless terminated. So is
right.
That how the contract continued under the same terms?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. It certainly is. The contract, as I recall, had a 135-day written notice provision, written termination provision, and Underwriter Service never gave written notice of termination of the contract. So it continued from 2002 on through 2007. So it's against this backdrop of Underwriter Service owing more than $1 million in return commissions and not sharing its internal calculations with Arch about how much it owed Arch that this request for modification of the contract came up in early 2007. So let me turn to the contract formation issues and questions 1A and 1B. There's no valid or effective modification of the reinsurance agreement as a matter of law for at least six reasons. First, under Texas law, which applies under the reinsurance agreement, all three parties needed to agree to any amendment or modification. You see this in section 20.06 of Joint Exhibit 1, that's the reinsurance agreement. It requires that amendments be in writing and signed by all parties. This requirement that all three parties sign any addendum to the contract or any modification to the contract carried forward in the addendum number 11, which is at issue here, and that's joint exhibit 12. It recited the parties were all three parties. It had signature blanks for all the parties, all three parties, State National, Arch, and Underwriter Service. And the point is that whether the alleged agreement was oral, whether it was in writing, in email communications, which has been contended by underwriters, or whether it was in the addendum number 11, which was exhibit 12, State National never agreed. And regardless of the form of the alleged agreement, State National's agreement was required under the terms of the reinsurance agreement. It was stipulated during the jury charge conference at Reporter's Record, Volume 5, 195 to 196, that there's no evidence that State National ever agreed to any modification of the reinsurance agreement. And Judge Evans, at that point, makes clear on the record, before he obtained that stipulation, that he was defining addendum number 11 as very broad as possible, including the emails, including oral communications, including everything leading up to that document, addendum 11. Second, even Underwriter Service agrees that State National had to agree to a modification of the contract if State National was affected by that modification of the contract. And it is absolutely clear under the facts of this case that State National was affected. Under Section 5 of the reinsurance agreement, the original agreement, State National bore no responsibility for any losses whatsoever, any claims. And Arch Re bore responsibility for 100%. The loss caps that were inserted in the emails, that were in some of the emails, and that were in addendum number 11, changed that dramatically because they capped Arch Re's loss for claims made under the policies. So there was going to be a gap, potentially. Arch Re would be liable up to certain limits, and above that, State National was back on the hook for whatever amounts were paid on the claims. And that was not what State National bargained for in its reinsurance agreement. And in fact, it would never have agreed to that. And there's an offer of proof to that effect.
But isn't there an argument to be made that the modifications as proposed and allegedly agreed to by two of the three parties really only affected the commissions paid and amounts owed as between them, so that if State became or at some point was to get on the hook for some additional amounts, they would just turn back to the two parties?
I know that argument has been made, Your Honor, and I don't think it flies at all because because the caps are the caps, and there's nothing in the argument has also been made that, well, Underwriter Service was liable above the caps. There's nothing in any of the email correspondence or any of the addendum or in addendum 11 that obligates Underwriter Service to be responsible over and above those caps. So there's nothing in the record that shows that underwriters would be responsible. In addition, what was important about the caps to Arch Re was its ability to reduce the reserves that it put up for incurred but not reported losses or incurred but not reported claims. And without State National's agreement, Arch Re could not reduce its reserves. So it very much impacted State National. The final thing I would say on that, Your Honor, is that State National did have a very careful review process to pick the reinsurers with whom it worked. Arch Re was an A-rated company, and to say that State National would just go back to the parties is disregarding the language of the reinsurance agreement and also the impact that these proposed addendums had on State National potentially by increasing its risk and increasing its exposure. Third, Your Honor, even and going back to the argument that underwriter service might be liable up and over and above the caps, the reinsurance agreement had an anti-assignment provision, and that was in section 20.03 of the reinsurance agreement. And if underwriter service had assumed the obligations or been assigned the obligations that Arch Re had under the original reinsurance agreement, then that would violate the anti-assignment provision. And Arch underwriters has absolutely no response to that point in their brief. Fourth reason, Arch Re withdrew its offer. The court's familiar from looking at the record that Mr. Glick from Arch Re signed addendum number 11. He had this email correspondence. When his superiors found out, they called the intermediary BMS and they called State National and said, Glick did not have actual authority to sign that. We are not doing that deal. We withdraw our offer. State National had not signed addendum 11 yet. And as I said, there's an offer of proof that they never would have signed that because of the impact it would have on their risk.
What was the time period between the alleged verbal agreement between the two parties and Arch Re's notification that they weren't going to sign the actual written agreement?
Well, the email that underwriters points to is dated February 26th, late in the day. I think it's Joint Exhibit 89 and also Joint Exhibit 100. I think they're duplicates. The first draft agreement, Addendum 11, was not circulated until July. And the final Addendum 11 that was signed by Mr. Glick and by underwriters was in December. I believe it was December 11th when Mr. Glick presented the signed agreement to his superiors. They called the other parties right away and said, this is not a deal we agree to. We withdraw our offer. If Glick had apparent authority, he had apparent authority, but he had no actual authority, we withdraw. So it happened in a couple of days.
But in that time period, the course of dealings between the two parties actually changed so that it reflected the proposed terms? Or
no. I mean, for example, there were supposed to be loss caps in place for 2002. But underwriters went ahead and invoiced Arch above the caps supposedly in place for 2002, and Arch paid that. So those loss caps were not treated as being in place. Moreover, Your Honor, this is yet another reason, and the next reason, the fifth reason, why there's no effective modification as a matter of law. The terms of the proposed modification changed dramatically between the February email and the December addendum 11. There was a lot of language added to the cap language. There was an elimination of the loss carry forward provision that was not added until July. And so for these reasons, another reason why there's no valid modification is it's clear these were a series of ongoing negotiations. Terms were being added, terms were being taken out. If you compare Exhibit 100, Exhibit 124, Exhibit 130, Exhibit 140, and Exhibit 12, those are the various iterations of alleged agreements or drafts of addendum number 11. And the court can see changes in the cap language, addition of the loss carry forward provision, and a number of other things that show that this was a series of ongoing negotiations. Final reason that the contract was not modified is that the jury question was improper. It was immaterial because it isolated on only two aspects of the alleged agreement and did not ask whether all of the parties, including State National, but all of the parties agreed to all material terms. There were a number of other material terms, like the loss caps, like the elimination of the carry forward provision, that all parties really needed to agree to, and the court's charge did not require the jury to make that finding of agreement by all parties to all material terms. And I see my time is up, and I will have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Leatherby. Mr. Herman.
May it please the Court. Your Honors, I've brought a diagram with me this morning that sort of depicts the business arrangement. I suspect the Court fully understands the business arrangement, and this may be more distraction than help.
Well, let's give them a minute.
I like charts.
Let's give them a minute before we start their time.
I also have handout size charts, which I can leave
okay,
with the
yes,
clerks if you'd
well,
like.
If you'll just approach the bench and provide those. We usually can read these easier than some of the exhibits. And did you provide these to counsel?
I saw the book this morning, Your Honor.
All right, let's begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, on behalf of the appellee, I would submit that there's really nothing particularly unique about either the state national business plan or, frankly, the circumstances of this particular case. This is a pure contract case, and it is decided correctly by the court below on pure contract principles. The parties have obviously reached a clear division in their views of how the case should be assessed. Arch focuses all of its attention on State National, which is a non-party to the case, and on the written addendum number 11, which they say does not complete a modification or accomplish a modification. USA, my client, relies instead on the 2007 verbal and written communications, which we say accomplished the modification, and the jury agreed, and obviously Judge Evans similarly agreed. And we view the written addendum as merely confirmatory evidence and possibly a convenient memorial, but the modification that's at work here is the result of the conversations and emails that were exchanged in February of 2007. The case, the reason I drew this particular chart is to try to refocus the attention on what this case is really about. And if I may, this case is not about State National. It is about this premium division and commission division in the Burton Agreements that operates only between my client, Underwriter Service Agency, and Arch Reinsurance. And the only fact issue at involved in the trial was whether Arch and United or Underwriters Service reached an understanding to modify the commission arrangement that existed between the two of them. The testimony was that State National had no interest whatsoever in the commission split. And indeed, the quota share reinsurance agreements expressly states that State National has no interest in the commission split and has no responsibility for how Arch and USA may decide to split up the applicable premiums and commissions.
What about their argument, though, that State is then exposed to uninsured risk?
It's not true. State's ultimate protection, and if I may, in this arrangement, was that it obtained a full indemnity obligation from Arch Reinsurance, and it obtained a similar full indemnity obligation from Underwriter Services. The only economic risk that State National had in this business arrangement was if both Arch Reinsurance and Underwriter Service became unable to cover the obligations. That is the only economic risk. That risk never changed based upon the arrangement that was made on this commission split. It did not alter that risk whatsoever. The facts of this case, I think, are extremely unique, and I'm not going to go over them in detail. But the evidence, basically almost uncontroverted evidence, was that Arch's representative, a gentleman named Phil Glick, who held the title of Director Treaty Property and was the person primarily responsible for dealing with my client's representatives, that he intentionally communicated to my clients in February of 2007 that Arch had agreed to a new commission split. And he did so knowing that my clients would rely on that communication and would believe that they had reached a modification. Mr. Glick admitted that he knew that at the time. And he knew and understood that the result of that communication and that belief on my client's part was that my clients would continue to sell and service these policies under the program, which they did for another 10 months and sold something over $10 million of insurance, which generated a large amount of premiums or commissions to Arch Reinsurance.
So let me ask this. So in February at the time Glick made this communication, was that the point in time at which someone would have had to have given the 135 days notice of termination?
Yes, or before that. These conversations about modifying the commission provision had actually extended over a period of time, and the evidence is my client met with Mr. Glick for the first time in like August of 2006 and opened this conversation. But my client always had the contractual privilege to give notice and terminate the arrangement, whether it was done before March 1 or after March 1. But what happened here is we were induced not to do that and instead to continue selling and servicing the policies because we were led to believe that an agreement had been reached that would make this arrangement economic again for my client. All of the conversations concerning the February agreement passed through the intermediary, BMS intermediaries, and the witness for BMS, Mr. Victor Marks, testified that Mr. Glick confirmed to him at the end of February that they had a deal. Mr. Harvey, my client's representative, confirmed to Mr. Marks that there was a deal. And Mr. Marks believed at that point that there was a deal. And indeed, the testimony is that from that point forward, there were accounting procedures that were put in place that gave effect to this this modification. So the testimony really was almost overwhelming, and I think the jury found that to be the case. What Arch's real complaint here, it seems to me, as it relates to the jury charge and the issues that were submitted, is that the court did not submit a but-for issue that they wanted submitted. Well, they really wanted two issues submitted. Number one, they wanted an issue submitted to inquire whether State National had agreed to addendum number 11. That was a non-issue. They had never signed, and no one disputed that fact. But they wanted a but-for issue submitted with respect to the estoppel issue, which was number two. And what they wanted was an issue that but-for Arch's request that State National sign or not sign the addendum number 11, would State National have signed it? And the judge correctly denied that because, at least in my common sense, it's asking the jury to decide the case not on the facts as they existed, but rather to decide the case on what would have been the result had the existing facts been different. So I think the court correctly declined that request. The counsel spoke briefly about the revocation issue, and at least in my mind, that's a fairly simple issue. If the answer to questions 1A and 1B, is yes, the parties made a modifying agreement in February of 2007. Then there is nothing to be revoked in December of 2007 when Arch's CEO, Mr. Rathgaber, attempts to revoke the prior agreement. The revocation would be applicable only to an open offer. A revocation, there's no revocation privilege for a completed agreement. So I think the revocation issue is a non-issue. The estoppel question 2A that counsel speaks to, I personally view the estoppel question as being borderline irrelevant. I think the court's judgment rests on the answers to questions 1A and 1B, which are, was there an agreement made, and to which the jury responded yes. Given those answers, the estoppel question becomes surplusage. It would only come into play if the answer had been there was no modifying agreement in February of 2007, and the issue then became whether State National would have signed or would have signed the addendum number 11 later.
So your position is that even if the estoppel question was incorrectly submitted, it's basically irrelevant because of the prior questions?
Yes, Your Honor. I think the case is decided on questions 1A and B, where the jury found that by virtue of Mr. Glick's conduct, the parties made an agreement to modify the commission split provision of the quota share reinsurance agreement, and that is essentially the end of the case. The other point that Arch brings up that probably merits some discussion is the retroactivity issue, as they call it. And the question is whether, from their perspective, is whether the modifying agreement that changed the commission arrangement from a structure where there was a 27% minimum and a 30 provisional to one where there was a 30% minimum, whether that was intended to be retroactive to prior years in order to remove or release the liability that had accrued over those prior years for return commissions. I think that is answered by the jury's response to question 1B, where the jury found specifically, yes, it was retroactive. In fact, question one was split into, was the commission change forward-looking, and the answer, the jury's answer was yes, and was it retroactive, and the jury's answer was yes. But furthermore, the literal language of the addendum shows that it was retroactive and intended to be retroactive to release that prior liability, because the addendum speaks in terms of agreement years. And it says that the new commission rate will apply to, quote, each agreement year. And each agreement year is a defined term in the quota share reinsurance agreement. And it says the each agreement year is the initial year of 2002 and every successive year thereafter. So in order to apply the literal language of the addendum, what you do is you go back and you recalculate for each agreement year the commission split and the return commissions, if any, that might accrue. And when you do that, it comes up to a forgiveness of the prior return commission liability. And indeed, Arch's CEO, Mr. Rathgaber, testified that the commission and return commission calculation is a rolling calculation that occurs every single year, because all events that may impact the result of the calculation for a given year do not necessarily occur in that year. They may occur in successive years. So you have to go back in every agreement year and make that recalculation. Um, Well, there's one. Oh, the other thing that I did want to speak to before I sit down is the attorney's fees issue, just to make sure that the court understands at least my position, which I suspect you do. The attorney's fees that were awarded by Judge Evans are challenged here on the theory that these were akin to a defensive mirror image declaratory judgment pleading, which is simply not the case. The declaratory judgment pleading under which the attorney's fees were awarded was Arch's request for a declaratory judgment. In fact, what happened here is when Arch filed its suit, it didn't sue simply for breach of contract. It anticipated our modification claim and sought a declaratory judgment that it believed would preempt or defeat our modification claim. Consequently, in the trial court, we had a declaratory judgment action pending that covered the modification claim, which the jury found, as a matter of fact, to be valid. And it was on that claim that Judge Evans entered the attorney's fees, which we think were entirely proper. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Herman. Mr. Leatherberry, rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor, there's a lot to cover, and I'll try to jump around as little as possible, but I think it's impossible. Whether questions 1A and 1B refer to emails or oral communications or addendum number 11, they're immaterial for the same reasons that I initially argued to the court. All three parties were required to agree to any modification of the contract, particularly when the modification through the addition of loss caps impacted State National. It was not just relating to the commissions between the parties. It related to the loss caps, and it related to Arch Re's ability to improve its financial condition by reducing its reserve amount that it had to keep for carrying to cover claims on the policies because of the loss caps. We've referred the court to two cases which we believe are the principal cases that support our position. The Hill case involving a joint operating agreement between a number of parties, and the court held that when all of the parties had not mutually agreed to the amendment was ineffective. And the Mandrill case, also a Court of Appeals case, where it was held that invoices did not unilaterally modify a contract. We believe that, and we've discussed the cases cited by underwriters, and we believe our cases are much more apposite to this point of whether all three parties had to agree to any modification of the contract. Being liable for 100% of the losses is, we think, in the offer of proof, State National would have testified so if Judge Evans had allowed it, is significantly different from having an indemnity. And it's particularly significantly different from having an indemnity from Underwriter Service, where Underwriter Service is claiming that its financial condition is very poor and precarious. If State National was irrelevant, I'll ask the court then, why did Underwriter Service insist on submitting question 2A and 2B in terms of addendum number 11? And if addendum number 11 is irrelevant, I'd ask the court the same question. Question 2 is tied to addendum number 11. And the reason it was submitted was that Judge Evans held as a matter of law during the jury charge conference that and during the motions for directed verdict that State National was that Underwriters was liable to Arch Re in the stipulated amount of more than $2 million unless they had an affirmative defense that excused their liability. Equitable estoppel was the affirmative defense that they chose to ride. It was the one that they put in question two, and they expressly did not ask the jury to go on and make additional findings about additional affirmative defenses in 3, 4, and 5 when the jury answered yes to a portion of question 2. Now, question 2A is immaterial because question 2B is the one that accurately submitted the elements of equitable estoppel under the PJC and under Texas law. In question 2B, the jury failed to find equitable estoppel, and question 2A submits none of the elements of equitable estoppel. It submits none of the elements of quasi-estoppel, which is underwriter's argument now to try to salvage question 2, and it just simply is immaterial. It is not a proper basis, as my objection to Judge Evans was in the trial court, to make a finding of equitable estoppel because State National's failure to sign was caused by Arch Re. It was a backhanded way to get a tortious interference claim in, and Judge Evans properly ruled they hadn't pled it. He wasn't going to let it in, but he was going to submit question 2A as a form of equitable estoppel, although not one that tracked any of the elements under Texas law. The offer could be revoked in December because State National had never agreed to, and it was stipulated that State National never agreed to modify the contract, either in Addendum 11 or any email or any oral communication or anything. And so the offer was still outstanding because State National had not accepted, and the mutual simultaneous assent of all three parties was required. Thank you, Your Honors.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Leatherberry. Mr. Herman, we appreciate your arguments and your briefing today. Ms. Weber and Ms. Cooley, we appreciate your assistance as well. Your case is submitted, and you all are excused.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We have a 10-minute recess until our 10:30 case. Our guests, you're welcome to stay. We'll be right back in just a few minutes. If you'd like to stay and hear one more case, we'd sure love to have you.
All rise.